For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, one of our Sangha members, Sarah Lytle. She's been a member of participating in Zen activities here on Irving Park as well as at Rockefeller Chapel. And for the entire time I've known you, and I guess the rest of us, you've been a master's degree candidate at the University of Chicago Divinity School and the School of Social Service Administration. She's done. She recently presented her thesis at the University of Chicago. It's from Mindfulness to Ethics. That mindfulness to emptiness, an ethic of care influenced by the doctrine of non-self. And presentation and defense of the thesis was really well attended by students of the School of Social Administration, the Divinity School, and by Dragons, and was well received and inspired a great deal of talk. And it's notable that Sarah has been really pretty strongly influenced by the great Indian thinker Shantideva, by his work, Bodhicaryavatara, the way of the Bodhisattva, or the road of awakening. Mm. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for the introduction. So as Douglas mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about this thesis that I wrote just a little bit ago as kind of the culmination of 4 years of graduate study in divinity and both social work. And part of that education was academic study, part of it was field work and training in chaplaincy and psychotherapy and social work. And so the task of our thesis, which was the final requirement for the divinity school, the Master of Divinity degree, was to kind of engage kind of what we had been thinking about for the past few years and give a public talk on it. And so this is a little bit of an abbreviation of that talk, and the paper is much longer than I will get into here, but if you're interested in reading it, I'd be happy to pass it along. And as Douglas also mentioned, for the thesis, I drew on Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva, which is right here, as an example of compassionate engagement in the world from a non-self perspective, and then place this text in conversation with my own experiences as both a professional and non-professional caregiver. So this project considers how the Buddhist premise of non-self, or emptiness of self, changes the practice of caregiving, and what that insight with that ontological framework can offer to the caregiving relationship. So I approached this project from multiple different identities and roles as a practicing Buddhist and as an academic, as a chaplain and clinical social worker, and as a professional caregiver and a familial one. And the varying experiences I've had in each of those roles have led me to the questions that I explored in the thesis. And it's also very exciting for me to have my mom here, who has also, in many ways, brought me to this project. She's also a practicing Buddhist and was my introduction to the Dharma. And she's also a nurse. And so for my whole life, these questions, I think, have been very live, but in the background. So it means a lot for me to bring her here and be talking to you guys about it. So some of the questions that I began with. How does our experience change when informed by the recognition that our suffering is inseparable from that of the other? What changes about care if we take as fundamental the truth that suffering characterizes life for all beings and not just the particular ones in front of us? And at the core, I'm asking, what does it mean for the caregiving relationship to be based on the fact that we are creatures who suffer together? So I'd like to begin with a little bit of how I came to this project, sort of the genealogy of the ideas. So when I first moved to Chicago, I was fresh out of college, and I had a job, sort of a Service Corps job, working as a hospital chaplain. And I was a 22-year-old lifelong Buddhist from Northern California, working with patients in a Chicago hospital, and most of them identified as Christian. And initially, I was, in addition to learning how to pray and all of those things, I was kind of puzzled and confused by what appeared to be a really big difference between my view as a Buddhist and what I encountered in the beliefs of both my patients and my colleagues, most of whom believed in something called a soul. And as a lifelong Buddhist, I kind of grew up with the idea that my tradition not only denies the existence of a soul, but denies the existence even of a self. And as many of you all know, since the time of its origin, the Buddhist tradition has one of the thoughts that has characterized it, in distinction from its surrounding religious traditions, was the idea of anatman, or non-self, which affirms that there is no self that is enduring, changeless, and essential. And this is pretty important to my view as a Buddhist, and as I'll hope to get to talk about later, also foundational to my pursuit of a career in caring for others. So as I continued my training, this question kind of persisted. It became less disturbing and more just curious as time went on. But I kind of wanted to know what it meant that my worldview was so different from that of my patients. And the second theme, that the second teacher I have encountered in the past four to six years, was that simultaneous with my graduate education and training has been my own experience navigating my father's terminal illness. And I think I've given at least one Dharma talk on that experience here, and it's been a very big teacher for me. And so my questions about caregiving and what exactly my tradition has to say about it, and if it can help me at all, took on a new importance as I found myself as the adult child of a parent who has been dying. And while there have been moments of this process that have felt meaningful and spiritual, much of it has been very difficult and painful and complicated. And at a certain point, I remember telling my program director that I just couldn't read any more books about caregiving because I felt like it wasn't turning out how I thought it was supposed to turn out. And she very graciously told me, then stop reading them. And so part of my decision to return to a text from my own tradition came out of this question of what does my tradition have to help me through this process? And this experience has also involved being the recipient of a lot of care and friends, colleagues, supervisors, teachers, therapists, this community have all helped me and cared for me throughout this process. Grief has a way of making you cry in strange places, so strangers too, people I don't even know, have offered me care and comfort. So this brings me to kind of a big point that I talked about in my thesis and thought a lot about, which is that people who train professionally as caregivers will also always find themselves in the role as non-professional caregivers, as caregivers for family or friends or their community, and as themselves patients. And this has a lot to do with kind of what I hope to make clear through this project, which is that caring for and being cared for by others is itself a fundamental human activity. It's what we do as beings in the world with other beings. So the third theme that led me to this idea has been the popularization and medicalization of mindfulness. And currently, I would say that I think mindfulness meditation is one of the most prominent expressions and engagements with Buddhist thought in popular culture, and is especially ubiquitous in the fields of health and mental health and wellness, all fields that I've been training in. So now prevalent in hospitals, classrooms, your iPhone, it's often seen as the best tool that Buddhism has to offer. by way of remedying suffering and enhancing well-being. As a chaplain, as a social worker, I have taught mindfulness and led mindfulness workshops in secular settings and have found it useful at times. And at the same time, I was also studying the philosophical and historical origins of my tradition. So that gave me some questions. So my stance toward mindfulness is not that it deviates from real Buddhism, and I don't really challenge its adoption. I do think it's important to heed the growing number of calls to consider the complexity of what it means to extract a tool from its tradition and employ it for a range of purposes, from the benign aim of wellness to the more ethically fraught aim of facilitating corporate success and capitalism. But I argue that mindfulness does not exhaust the possible contributions of Buddhism to care. And indeed, what I suggested in my thesis, that this preoccupation with mindfulness perhaps obscures recognition of what may be the most valuable contribution that Buddhist thought can make, which is that these tools, like mindfulness, are not, like Zazen, are not just functional tools to make us feel better. They're methods for changing how we understand ourselves and our relation to the world. Mindfulness, as commonly represented in secular settings, and neglects one of the foundational premises of Buddhist thought, which for Buddhists is the main reason for engaging in this practice. Specifically, that the suffering we experience is most basically due to our misperception of ourselves as enduring and separate selves. Central to a Buddhist analysis is the thought that the experiences of suffering and of responding to suffering characterize the lives of all beings. And the Buddhist response to this reality is to urge that while we should, of course, relieve suffering wherever we can, the most basic suffering is not fixed by typical remedies. From a Buddhist perspective, the real human predicament involves suffering that stems from the basic way in which we relate to ourselves, in particular as these selves that are distinct and separate. And so if this is the problem in the Buddhist context, it kind of made me think, well, what does that mean if we frame the problem of suffering in this way? How does that change a caregiver's response to suffering, which is also an attempt to answer that same problem of how do we respond to suffering? So the notion of non-self is crucial. The central Buddhist claim is that we are not, in fact, separate selves, that what we take to be these independent entities that comprise us are actually deeply intertwined with and constituted by countless phenomena. I won't get too much into the philosophical weeds of non-self, because many of you here are familiar with that. But the understanding of non-self that I used in this project was from Majjhimaka philosophy, a school of thought stemming from the works of the Indian Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, who lived around 150 to 250 CE. And this school of thought has been very influential in both Tibetan and East Asian traditions of Buddhism, both of which are also traditions of Buddhism that have profoundly shaped me and informed me. So the essence of this argument, the Majjhimaka holds that because everything is dependently arisen and interdependent, nothing really possesses an enduring essence or unchanging nature. So everything is empty of independent existence, even, indeed, especially what we take to be ourselves. Rather than recognizing ourselves as contingent processes that represent the coming together of causes and conditions, we see ourselves as discrete, wholly autonomous beings, separate from everything and everyone around us. This is partly what makes the reality of impermanence, something that in my professional training and personal life I've had to encounter a lot, so painful and difficult to accept. Our habitual attachment to a certain understanding of ourselves grows out of the fact that we're constantly living our lives trying to avoid recognizing our own impermanence. And according to this framing of our existence, the impermanence itself isn't really the problem. What causes suffering is a self-grasping with which we avoid confronting it. That's a little bit of the background of this kind of way of thinking about things and the philosophical foundations that I was thinking about as I was trying to make sense of my own experiences. And so one of the classical texts on the connection between non-self and ethical action is Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva, or the Bodhichara Avatara. And in this text, Shantideva, who was an 8th century Buddhist monk and scholar, offers instructions for compassionate engagement based on the concept of non-self. Instructions that I think can provide contemporary readers and listeners, like us, a different orientation to the suffering of others. It is an exposition of the path of the Bodhisattva. A classical text, it prevents the motivation for committing to this path and explains the qualities to be cultivated on it, the reasons for doing so, and the means for making them manifest. And the portion of the text that I centered my project on is the eighth of the work's 10 chapters. And in this chapter, Shantideva provides instructions that come about halfway through the chapter that describe the practice of exchanging oneself and others as a method for self-transformation and awakening. And this is a practice used by Buddhists to this day. When I talk a little bit more about it, you may recognize it. Written as a second person address to the reader, this famous meditative exercise offers techniques for understanding that suffering should be eliminated, not because of whose it is, not that it is because it's mine or yours, but simply because it is suffering. So I want to also clarify now that I see the idea of non-self helpful insofar as it influences the caregiver and the relationship between caregiver and receiver, and insofar as it helps the caregiver to offer helpful interpretation, perhaps. So I'm not suggesting that we try to convince those in our care of this philosophical orientation, but I do think it can provide us with an aspirational vision of the care encounter and a way in which to think about the meaning of the care we provide for others. So through reading Shantideva's instructions as though they were directed to me as a caregiver, kind of an exercise in imagining him sitting down with me and giving me some advice, four themes emerged. The first theme is that a non-self perspective brings with it the premise that we suffer together, meaning that the empathic imagination of the other's situation can begin with the recognition that we are already in the same boat, that what separates us is perhaps time and circumstance, but not really anything else. The second is that we must understand our own suffering if we are to help others in theirs, especially insofar as a caregiver's own person is their most important and present tool in the provision of care. The self-interrogation provided on the Buddhist path and urged by Buddhists is not separate from the practice of care, not something we can just do on our own time at the end of the week, but central to it. The third point is that suffering, in the final view of this exercise, is impersonal. We should respond to suffering not because it is attached to a particular person that we have identified as worthy of care, but because it is. And finally, the fourth conclusion is that that clinical practice itself can help us to understand these ideas, can help us more deeply realize the insights of non-self. Caregiving itself, being with others in their suffering, just like the meditation practice outlined in Shantideva's text, can be a method of self-transformation. So I'll get into these themes a little bit more, and if you have any questions about ones that I didn't cover, can ask me them at the end of the talk. But I would like to now just read you a few of these verses I've been talking about. So Shantideva's famous instructions begin by instructing the reader to meditate on her sameness with other living beings. Strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. And joy and sorrow all are equal. Thus be guardian of all, as of yourself. The hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, the body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. So Shantideva urges us to recognize that all sentient beings are alike, and their wish to experience joy and avoid suffering. Suggesting how radical Shanti Deva's point is, which is that because we are not unique in our wish, we should care, therefore, for others with the same intensity that we care for ourselves. He gives an example, which is that even though the various parts of the body are distinct from one another, the hand is distinct from the foot, we regard them as constituting a single body that we naturally think should be kept and guarded. Might indifferent beings likewise be regarded as distinct but nevertheless part of the same body? We have become habituated to thinking that a collection of skin and muscle and bone, this skin bag, is me, but Shanti Deva's wager is that we can likewise habituate ourselves, train ourselves to thinking that all suffering beings warrant the same attention as different parts of our body do. Pema Chodron explained these verses in a way that I found very helpful. She draws upon the experience of being ill and in the hospital. Once we have had the experience of ourselves being patients, we have a new understanding of how it feels to have people walk in and out of our hospital room at all hours of the day and night, or to have needles and tubes stuck into our bodies, to be confused and in pain. We might then, after having had that experience, have more understanding when our loved one is in the hospital and is uncharacteristically irritable with us. If we are caregivers ourselves, we might have a greater capacity to understand our patient's repeated pressing of the call button or their protestation against another nurse's visit. So once we've had an experience that we see someone else having, we might be more able to understand why they might be acting in ways that we find objectionable, if we can understand that it's coming from a place that is painful. So having had these experiences ourselves, it's hard to relate superficially to someone else who's in this position. And as I'll talk about in a little bit, that can present us with some difficulties as well when we feel too close to the experience that we're encountering. So similarly, if we reflect on how all beings want happiness and freedom from suffering, just as we do, we can cultivate the same kind of understanding with all beings. Different beings and their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. These verses also exemplify a rhetorical move that Shanti Deva continues to deploy throughout the text that I think is quite interesting. He is at once presenting arguments for non-self and exploiting the self-interest that is natural for everyone to have. So this is an interesting departure from other ways of instilling compassion or altruistic behavior based on reducing one's self-oriented behavior. Shanti Deva is suggesting that we undermine our self-regard by at the same time leveraging it. Given that it is so natural to have concern for our own suffering, we ought, upon realizing the emptiness of our own, of ourselves, to find it natural to want to ameliorate all suffering. So this is part of what happens through the process of equalizing self and others. We don't disregard ourselves. We expand our notion of self to include the other. So this example of the foot and the hand might be sort of underwhelming for a reader expecting an analytical demonstration of the non-self doctrine. It's like, yes, of course my hand will fix my foot if it's hurting, but our bodies are connected in ways that we don't really, that are just different from other beings. So I think that this is perhaps better read as a metaphor for how we can come to regard others were we to realize the truth of non-self than it is an argument for that doctrine. So there is debate amongst scholars on the intended purpose of Shanti Deva's instructions. One way to read it is more analytical in nature, framing this ethic as something to be developed through thought and analysis, argumentation. Another option, the one I am taking, is a meditational reading. The meditational reading takes these verses as presenting objects of meditation, which I take as chiefly meant to transform the mind through contemplation and meditation, shifting the way one sees others gradually, rather than as a logical analysis of the doctrine of non-self. This might bring to mind the three trainings that are at the heart of Buddhist practice: listening, thinking, and meditation. The last phase, meditation, involves the transformation of the mind so as to bring about genuine perceptual knowledge of the truth of Buddhist teachings. These steps are all linked. Reading about the doctrine of non-self, or listening to me talk about it, might make conceptual sense, but that in itself does not change our behavior toward others. Or else we'd all be enlightened by now. Understanding Shantideva's point is one thing, but really habituating ourselves to have this view is another matter. We can understand or believe a lot of things and not implement them in our daily lives. Pema Chodron describes these instructions as antidotes for the narrow, confused perspective of me and mine. We can discuss philosophically the emptiness of self and think our way through its implications, but this isn't really enough to undo our deeply habituated self-regard. So this brings me to the next argument of Shantideva, which is that his final meditation in these instructions is that ultimately, suffering itself should be understood as impersonal. He continues, suffering has no possessor, therefore no distinction between self, no distinctions can be made in it. Since pain is pain, it is to be dispelled. What use is there in drawing boundaries? But why dispel the pains of all? You cannot argue in this way. If my pain is removed, so too should that of others. If theirs is not, then neither should be mine. So this exercise, then, would have us understand that suffering should be eliminated simply because it is suffering. So perhaps the heroism of the Bodhisattva, who vows not to rest before freeing all beings from suffering without exception, is thus made possible through understanding suffering as ultimately impersonal. This might seem counterintuitive, or to miss something important about how we think about patience, suffering, and narrative. There's been a movement to humanize suffering, especially in medical contexts, where often people can be just moved around as bodies, and to realize that it is a particular person who is suffering with a story and a narrative and a life, rather than a body or a disease. This is an important pursuit, and I'm not suggesting we abandon it. But depersonalizing suffering does not mean making it anonymous. I don't think this interpretation of it would be consistent with the rest of Shantideva's text. However, there's a difference between humanizing suffering, acknowledging that there is a human being or another sentient being who's experiencing it, and fusing someone together with their suffering. Humanizing someone's experience does not have to mean taking it personally. When we do this, it can actually become harder to see beyond it. Thus, by viewing suffering as impersonal and universal, I think that we are able to appreciate the human whose story contains suffering, while yet understanding them as much bigger than the suffering they're experiencing. It is this impersonality that I actually think can help us get out of the way and allow care to take place. I also think that as perhaps by attending suffering just because it is suffering rather than because it is tied to a particular story enables us to respond to it in a more sustainable way. A non-self perspective can also help us let go of our attachment to certain outcomes and caregiving. We can recognize both that things going well aren't due solely to us, and neither are things going badly. What is in our control is our intentions and our contribution to the process, but the ultimate outcome is not. While the doctrine of non-self encourages empathy and connection with others, the practice itself and the warning against self-grasping helps us to make sure that we're doing it effectively, with healthy clinical boundaries. In fact, this insight of non-self offers us another kind of boundary, one in which we are both empathetic and also recognize our limited role in the healing process. And finally, I think caregiving from this perspective can help us to reduce our own suffering as well. If one takes as true the Buddhist argument that self-grasping is the cause of our suffering, then that which reduces our self-grasping is healing. Through caring for the suffering of others, we actually engage in the transformation required for reducing our own. Like Shantideva's verses, caregiving itself can be seen as a way in which the view of non-self can be fully realized. Through encountering others in their suffering, we engage in a similar practice of transforming our habituated minds away from self-grasping and toward non-self. The realization of non-self, not just the analytical understanding, is what transforms our deeply ingrained habitual tendencies, and thus makes it possible to engage in the ethical path of the Bodhisattva. So, were I to take Shantideva's instructions to heart as a caregiver, this would mean not only understanding them analytically, reading them in a book, writing about them for a thesis, but also practicing them. Caregiving can be one way of doing this. Just as I have taken Shantideva's instructions to think about the implications of non-self, the experience of caring for others has helped me also better understand and practice caregiving through this perspective. The practice of care, in which we come face to face with the reality of what it means to have a human body, can help us to become less hardened to the suffering of others. Our hearts can become more tender and open as we expand our net of concern to include not only ourselves or our loved ones, but also patients, strangers, and the whole world. So my initial anxiety as a new chaplain in training was that the differences in my theology, specifically this idea of non-self or non-soul, would make it impossible for me to be a minister or a chaplain or whatever it was I was doing. And while it does impact my practice of care, my ministry, as we call it in the Divinity School, in the ways I explored, this does not present a difference that is incommensurate with the practice of care. So we're always engaging across difference. And as a Buddhist chaplain ministering in primarily Christian settings, I have had the opportunity to think critically about what it is that facilitates care and communication, if not a common language. While it may be obvious that I, as a Buddhist, do not share a common language, this can be an issue even for those who share the same tradition. For instance, a Baptist Christian ministering to an Episcopalian Christian, or even to another Baptist Christian, even, is likely to encounter differences in meaning while using the same language. So finally, this thesis was kind of an exercise for me to think about what it meant to engage rigorously with my own tradition, while at the same time using it to help me understand others. So attachment to our own views is a problem for everyone, for caregivers and everyone else. And in order to allow others to be themselves, we have to let go of our own agenda and our own version of the story. Rather than clinging to ourselves and our own way of making sense of the world, we have to get out of the way. Buddhism provides tools for interrogating our worldview, how we see the world and each other, and this self-examination is required if we are to be truly with others. So, that is what I have for you today. There's a lot more to read in here, but I figured we could now just talk about it. Because one of the best parts about presenting this was just that I kind of was able to get these ideas out of my own brain and hear what other people had to think of them. Because sometimes the academic world can feel very kind of like you're just rattling around in a little cage. So I'd love to hear any questions or thoughts. And if there's something I didn't cover and you want to hear more, I'm happy to go that direction as well.
I'm curious how your or the Buddhist belief in Anatman and Christian, because quite frankly, this is all in America and at least culturally Christian context, belief in the eternal soul complicates caregiving for someone like you during life care. And specifically, what's going to happen to me when I die?
Yeah.
And having someone that you're caring for ask you that, the Buddhist answer is very different than the Christian answer.
Yeah.
And it seems to be an incredibly important question if you're dying.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's a very practical, grounded question of like how these ideas actually work out in the world. I think in my experience, my response to that would probably to be to make clear that my own perspective and where that comes from, or to help someone navigate through their own meaning system about what that means for them. But I think, yeah, as I mentioned, I don't think giving the Buddhist answer as it is kind of as it is would necessarily be what I would do. But I think perhaps thinking more about what that question means and what it comes from. Because in a way, were I to give an answer, that might not actually be that helpful. So, yeah, I guess it's in a way kind of a my own kind of Buddhist training and practice kind of helps me be in that moment and understand perhaps what else is being asked with that question. It's a good question though. I think again, I don't think telling someone the Buddhist answer would necessarily be even what they were looking for. I think in those situations, I've been advised to kind of think, what else is being asked by that question, and how am I being looked to answer it? If that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can't exactly just reassure them that yes, of course you're going to heaven, because you can't say that in good faith.
Yeah.
Christians can't say
yeah.
In good faith, it's like, well, I sure hope so.
Mm-hmm.
But who really knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of it, too, is this kind of work of translation and learning how to use the language of the people that I'm working with in a way that, you know, makes sense to me and makes me still feel like I have integrity in what I'm talking about. Yeah.
That was a great question. Because I'm sitting here thinking. I told you before, my mother was a disciple. But, you know, a person who's suffering a lot might say, Champlin, do you believe in God?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sitting here wondering, in one sense, you know, compassion might lead you to say, yes, even if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, whatever. Mm-hmm. What would you do?
Oh, were you going to say something?
No, just
yeah.
Wrestling.
Oh, yes.
I have something to say later.
Okay. I have been in that scenario. And what have I said? I think sometimes I do say yes. In part because I don't know, or when I, you know, praying with some patients using very Christian language, it's kind of like I understand what I mean and what I'm talking about, and like, I wouldn't say it if it didn't feel like that also kind of was resonant with me. But I feel like in a crisis, sometimes it's not my brain that's kind of sifting through it intellectually, and it's just like, yes, or kind of... But I think, yeah, different kind of emotional valences provide for different kinds of conversations, I think, with people.
It's a pretty tough question.
Yeah, it is.
I can run it down from a friend of mine who was 2 weeks from death.
Yeah.
You know, I was visiting him. He said he believed in God, and went up to him and said, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure that was the right thing to do.
I think it's hard to know. And I think, again, kind of similar to my answer to Wade's question, is trying to kind of understand what's behind the question or what else is involved with the question. Like, is the question, what do you believe? Like, what do you think happens? Or is it kind of one for reassurance about, is what I believe okay? Is that real? Which is hard to decipher sometimes what that means.
Just wondering those circumstances, if worrying about whether I'm doing the right thing, what I'm supposed to do or not supposed to do, is, if that isn't really, you know, that's not really the point. Mm. The point is to help relieve the suffering of that person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a skillful means to, if you can come up with a prayer, then fine. If you can say, I believe that we're part of a greater life, I don't know what that means. And when I die, I believe that that greater life will continue in some way, then that's good.
Yeah.
When I look at people who are suffering in a different way than I suffer, I really question my separation from these people. For example, when I look at these boatloads of immigrants who are crossing the Mediterranean and perhaps many of them dying because they drown, and or they even probably, I don't know, you know, I can't explain that, but I just feel so much not there. It's just so far beyond what I can feel like I experience. I just wanted to talk about that. And then I wanted to talk about the whales and how they're suffering, because we don't get the news stories anymore about beachings, but there are many, many beachings, and for every beaching, there's probably 3 or 4 or 10 that died in the ocean. And I really get upset by the suffering of the refugees and the whales.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, so there's those two things. And the third thing that I am interested in is human beings who are autistic, or drunkards, or mentally challenged. And then I could say something about my own challenges, but I don't want to go there right now. So I'm wondering, how do you feel connected to a refugee, or an autistic person? Or maybe we could
leave out the whales. Yeah, no. No, I think all sentient beings.
Yeah.
Right? I think Thich Nhat Hanh has a really beautiful, like, short meditation where he kind of invites looking at a piece of paper and seeing everything that is contained within that piece of paper, and how, you know, within this sheet there are also trees and water and air, and so I think reflecting on also our implications in the suffering of others, the way that we are the way that we contribute to their suffering in ways that we don't even realize. I think that's another part of the coin as well. And I didn't quite get into this section of the project, but I talked a little bit about how allowing for the distinctness of the suffering of others, so not kind of flattening and being like, oh, it's all the same. I can understand what you're... I did a whole little section on how bad it feels sometimes when someone says, I completely understand. Because that's so rare, and but kind of allowing for empathy and connection while also recognizing that there is this big gulf in the way that we actually can't really understand what someone else is going through. And that doesn't mean we can't care for them or have compassion at all. But I think sometimes that can feel very overwhelming, and our response to that can sometimes be to be like, well, then I don't care at all, or to kind of flatten and make it the same thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't possibly understand.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can't. I guess it's what you choose to do with that kind of that separation. There is distinctness and separation. But how you kind of engage with that And I also talked a little bit about how my own kind of experiences with my dad have both helped me with patients, but also have gotten in the way as I kind of get, you know, I want it to look a certain way because, you know, I have my own attachment to the outcome. So being very aware of, like, when is that empathy helping and when is it kind of making it, or when is that similarity and experience helpful and when is it kind of a little bit confusing. And
can I just, you said that you had an attachment to the outcome.
Mm.
And were you saying that your attachment to the outcome with your dad is completely different, or not, well, completely is not the right word, is somewhat different from your attachment to the outcome with your patients?
It can be, but they can also kind of bleed together. Kind of my wish for my dad's experience to look a certain way can sometimes bleed over to when I see someone suffering in a similar way, perhaps. And I kind of bring in that view and kind of place it onto them. And again, I don't think that's, I think that's a very natural thing that we do, but it's, I think, being aware of it and being able to use it skillfully rather than either putting it away in a little box or letting it kind of drive the train. Yeah.
Wow. What an ambitious thesis topic. And life work.
Yeah.
You know. And but it Kari Kachkar is one of my favorite texts of all time.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I think of it as like a advanced training in compassion.
Yeah.
When you think of being able to suffer with, mm-hmm. to bear the intensity of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really appreciate, you know, like even that little instruction by Shantideva, you know, seeing the suffering of someone else, not different, but, you know, there's a lot of evocative language in that text, right, that really triggers one's own suffering,
mm-hmm.
as an antidote or a way to get beyond that, you know, to fully feel the impact of life, whales, trees.
Yeah.
You know, trees like send out signals to other trees that are suffering.
Yeah.
They send nutrients into the ground. So I've heard.
Yeah.
So like because we're all on this sinking ship together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, you know, it's so moving. I worked a lot with people dying early in my career,
mm-hmm.
and still do to some extent, and lost both my parents at a young age.
Yeah.
So this topic is really like to be with the pain,
mm-hmm.
of life and its end is really a heroic thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I just really appreciate you diving into it and sharing that experience with us.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. It's a really beautiful text. Really, kind of, it was a. Yeah, and it's very, very radical. So radical. I used the Padmakara translation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there are a couple lines. You know, someone you might remember, Aishin, quoted this when she was think it was Asian. Maybe somebody else remembers it differently. But there's a line in there that says, the protection of all beings is accomplished through the acknowledgement of one's own mistakes.
Mm.
And there's another line that says, the virtue of suffering, and I like Skilton's translation, but it says, the virtue of suffering is unparalleled because due to the shock it causes, delusions drop away and there arises compassion.
Mm.
And I think our Zazen is sitting with the suffering to the full extent of that. And then it eats away at this self-structure, this suffering.
Yeah.
You know, because you're talking about dualism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it really like slaps you in the face with, if you think you're not grasping,
just
get sick or
yep. Dying. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really a great thing.
Yeah. I love that line.
So I really appreciate your
thank you.
Effort in this world.
Thank you.
Maybe we have time for one more.
I'm interested if there, in your experience, has been any moments of a common language that you stumbled upon, like that you didn't expect, where like it was really easy to bridge that between, like, you know, someone else's faith and, you know, what you've been, what tradition you've been raised in, like an answer came that was made a lot of sense for both of you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, there definitely have been those moments. I think so often that it's like a Buddhist Christian encounter, almost always. And I think some like two things. One, like thinking about Jesus as a bodhisattva has been really helpful and fun in a way. And the second one is I find that often that common language comes when we're not talking theologically about stuff, like maybe doing something or I've had a couple of encounters that have involved painting nails, which has been like a really beautiful kind of like, oh, we're just bodies together. Yeah, or like, yeah, this kind of, and then one of the things I really appreciate about chaplaincy is in a hospital especially that you have a lot of time when a lot of other roles are more time constrained. And so often you kind of do have more time to just kind of sit there and let a common language come if it does. But I will pay attention to that this coming year and come up with some. Because it definitely does. It does happen. Like there is connection there. Great. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.